to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me today is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn. Hi, Mom.
And hi. Nice day again here.
Oh, it's a beautiful day. It's a beautiful day. This is the few days of autumn that we live for.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Exactly right.
So we have a really interesting book today on, and
we do.
Yeah, you know, I think people who've listened to us before know that we both love historical fiction, and World War II era fiction in particular. And I think we're not the only ones. There's something about that era that really, it was a time when, you know, you look back on it and you think, what would I have done if I had lived through that? Would I have been brave? Would I have stood up? And I think that's partly why it's such an attractive time for us.
Of course, I did grow up during the Second World War. I'm born in 1935, and so, you know, I was a kid, but we had, we had some things. We couldn't buy candy bars anymore because they were sending them all overseas. And to the troops. So, you know, it was interesting. There was interesting things. Yeah. Of course, we never had the horrific things that these people had in Europe. But
right.
You know.
So why don't you introduce our guest today, Mom?
Okay. Our guest today is Ellen Keith, and she has written a book called The Dutch Wife. And Ellen is a Canadian writer and graduate of the University of British Columbia's MFA program in creative writing. Her work has appeared in publications such as The New Quarterly and The Globe and Mail, and she has received the Anton Fiction Prize and the James Patrick Follansbee Memorial Scholarship in Creative Writing. And she lives in Amsterdam. The Dutch Wife is her first novel, and it's a good one. It's a page-turner.
And this is a novel that really explores the emotional side of some of the terrible things that happened there without being too distressing, because some people don't like to read about they don't like to read about all the bad stuff, and it's not that we're ignoring that in this book, but you see the kind of, it's uplifting, it's still uplifting, I feel.
Yeah, the bad stuff is not the main focus.
Ellen, welcome to Writer's Voices.
Thank you to the two of you so much for having me.
And you're calling us today from the Netherlands. And
yes.
Was your book first published in Europe, or was it published originally in the U.S.?
It first came out in Canada at the end of April, and it's come out in the Netherlands and in the Czech Republic over the summer, and then it came out in the U.S. in the beginning of September.
And did you write it originally in English or in Dutch or some other language?
Well, no, I definitely wrote it in English. I'm fluent in Dutch, but I don't think I would dare to try writing fiction in a second language. I definitely don't have that kind of mastery of it.
And so when it's published over there, like in the Czech Republic, is it translated or is it published in English there?
Yeah, it's been translated into both Czech and Dutch, which has been really interesting experience to have your work translated. And of course, I can read the Dutch edition of it, but I have no idea whatsoever how the Czech edition sounds.
Oh, that's, we'll talk a little more about that later, about what that process is like if you're involved in the translation process at all. But first, let's just talk about, give us a little feel for what the book is about and where the idea for this story came from.
Great. Well, as you mentioned, The Dutch Wife is my first novel, and it's set during World War II. It opens in May 1943 in Amsterdam. And the main character is a Dutch woman in the resistance, Marijke de Graaf, and she and her husband are arrested after they're caught helping some Jews and making crystal radios for people to listen to undercover. And they are actually deported from their homes in Amsterdam to separate concentration camps in Germany. And in Marika's effort to try to find her husband again, she faces a really terrible choice, even by concentration camp standards. She has the option of being potentially rerouted to the camp that she knows her husband is at if she would volunteer to join a camp brothel. And so that's the main part of the story takes off from there, and the novel focuses on three different storylines. Three different perspectives, that of Marika, the perspective of an SS officer who is one of the higher ranked officers at Buchenwald concentration camp, where she ends up. And then the third part of the story actually takes place in a completely different time and space in Argentina in the 1970s. And it follows the storyline of a young university student, Luciano Wagner, and he is arrested and imprisoned for joining in some student protests against the military junta that was ruling at the time.
So that was interesting to me, and that it was, you know, not only in difference in time, but difference in place. And was that because there were Nazi officials that were able to immigrate to Argentina? Is that the connection?
Well, definitely. I was really interested. I spent quite a bit of time traveling through South America, and I was very struck when visiting Argentina how there were certain places that had such a European, especially a German feel to it. It kind of felt like I was in the Alps, and the more I looked into it, the more I found out about this history, about how there were connections both before and during and after World War II with Nazi Germany, and I was really interested in how the country both had a lot of Jewish people that they took in, but also a lot of people who were fleeing persecution for their crimes in World War II.
Mm. Okay.
Do you feel that the presence of those former Nazis in Argentina was part of why there was this kind of tendency towards authoritarianism in Argentina in the 70s and even in more recent years?
I think it goes a lot beyond that. I mean, I'm sure that in some ways shaped it, because there were a lot of people who had quite good connections in that higher levels of government. But if you look at what was going on in Chile and Argentina at that time, I think a lot of it stems from major changes that were going on across the whole continent at the late 1800s and early 20th century, and in terms of, again, the idea of colonial power shifting, and I think that also played into it.
Okay. Well, let's go back to the character who goes to the brothel. And she was working in the brothel, a brothel for the inmates of the prison. Did those actually were did they? Well, I guess they didn't call it a prison, but to us it looked like
a concentration camp.
Concentration camp. Well, were there actually brothels for the prisoners?
Yes, and this is actually something I only discovered during the research process for the novel. I knew that I wanted to try to focus the storyline on this SS officer, Karl Müller, and I was trying to find ways to bring a strong female character into interaction with him. And I started off looking for information on military brothels that might have existed in the camps that were meant for the guards and the officers. And instead, I stumbled across a lot of fascinating research about these brothels that had been set up for prisoners. And this was something that Himmler introduced in starting around 1942 in 10 of the camps across the Third Reich. And it was initially part of a reward system that he had thought of. He was trying to find ways to boost the economic productivity of the prisoner labor force. And he thought that one way to stimulate them to work harder would be to have this tiered set of rewards. So there were things like you could maybe buy a packet of cigarettes, or you would be allowed to watch a film at the camp cinema, or take a book out of the library. And the ultimate prize, as he thought, was a visit to this camp brothel.
How about just feeding them?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, how about that?
You would think that would be higher on their priority list.
Yeah, just giving them enough to eat.
Yeah,
I was just amazed because I had, you know, I had read a lot about the concentration camps and so forth. And of course, whenever we went to the movies, there was always a newsreel, and the concentration camps were, you know, once some were liberated, they showed them and talked about them and everything, and so there was always a lot about it, and never was anything mentioned about this, about brothels in them. So I was, you know, I was amazed, really. Really was.
Well, it's unlikely that they would mention that in movies that kids go to anyway.
But I think either way, it's something that hasn't really come out very much at all, and only research in recent years, one German historian in particular has been doing a lot of work on it. But I think part of it is that there must have been a lot of stigma attached to this. And it's not that it was a huge percentage of the population who were involved in it. There were a couple hundred of girls who were involved over the course of the war. But of course, coming out of the war, I think a lot of these women were, I imagine that they would have been quite ashamed of what they had gone through, especially if in some way had been some sort of choice, albeit a very forced choice, in a way a choice between life and death. And on the other hand, you have prisoners who may have visited these brothels and knowingly contributed to the suffering of fellow prisoners. And I think that's something that becomes very morally complicated and something that would be very, very difficult to talk about and bring into the open after the war.
Well, I know that the Germans, the Nazis, kept precise records on the people in concentration camps, didn't they? I mean,
yes.
They knew who had died and everything and where they had died and how. And that's another thing that surprised me, that this had never come out before, because they were so precise about everything. So it was, this was good that, well, these women had to survive. You do what you have to do. And I understand that. I do.
I think it's true, too, that women who maybe cooperated with the Nazis in some sense outside of the concentration camp, but just in the towns, and were just doing it to survive, but they were punished afterwards, weren't they? By the community.
Oh, definitely. And I think you saw that for sure in Holland here, that there were lots of instances of people who were seen as being collaborators in one form or another, and certainly dating a Nazi soldier would have fallen into that. As some of these women were tarred, they had their heads shaved, forced to walk around mm-hmm. with a sign around their neck saying kind of German whore. And it was quite brutal in many ways. And I think when you're coming out of several years of living under occupation, I think everyone's idea of what is morally right and of where what falls on what end of the spectrum is completely shifted from where you would normally place things in everyday life.
And those women may have literally been forced into it, and yet they were held responsible for that, which is disturbing.
Yes, definitely. I think, we hear a lot about comfort women coming out of the Japanese side of the war, but I think whenever you have people in position of power, and especially a lot of men in power, these types of things can happen. And yeah, it's definitely not always something that people are comfortable talking about a lot after a conflict like this.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Ellen Keith, author of The Dutch Wife. This is a novel set in partially in World War II and partially in the 1970s in Argentina. And it took me a while to figure out the link between those two, although I did get it before the end. So it's a little bit of a mystery for a while. What made you want to do that, to tell really these stories set in two different times that didn't have an obvious link from the beginning, other than that both of the characters were being held against their will? Why'd you decide to structure the book like that?
Well, I'll start by telling you the reason that I had it on a broader scale, which was, as I said, when I visited Argentina, I was really struck by all these connections with Nazi Germany, and how, just in general, how much Buenos Aires really felt to me like being in a European city. But beyond that, I was really amazed that after the horrors of World War II and the case of mass genocide, that there were still so many other atrocities that took place in the century and the years following, and in many ways things that I feel are not as present in our public consciousness as World War II. I feel, for me, at least growing up in Canada, I knew barely anything about what happened in Argentina in the 1970s. And it was really only when I visited South America that I found out a little bit more. And I remember being there my first week and seeing every Thursday afternoon there are these mothers and grandmothers who march around the Plaza de Mayo, the main square in front of the presidential palace in Buenos Aires, and they are carrying photographs and signs demanding answers about their missing sons, daughters, and grandchildren who have been missing since the late 1970s or early 80s. And I was so moved by that when I saw it, and I started to learn more and more just how many parallels there were between what happened to these 30,000 people who disappeared under that military regime in Argentina, and in comparison to the way people were treated in concentration camps in Germany. I mean, obviously it's a different scale, but there were still a lot of overlap I saw, such as, for example, the way high-ranked SS officers would be living in villas right next to the camps with their families and maybe their dogs. And in here, in this book, you see that the naval officers are living just a floor away from all the prisoners in my book. And that's how it was in some of these hidden prisons. So I just really wanted to try to illustrate some of these parallels and just what humans are capable of.
Yes, that's right. We don't realize what humans are capable of, do we? In America, I don't think I ever heard about Argentina in the 70s. I don't think I ever heard about it.
Wow.
So
now another thing that was interesting in the Nazi concentration camps, they had, like you said, they had the brothels, they had cinemas, they had zoos.
Yes, that was interesting.
What was the purpose of the zoo?
Well, this was an unusual case. This was just in Buchenwald in particular, as far as I know, and it was because the first camp commander, his wife, so this is before my novel would have opened, his wife was, he built the zoo in a way to have something to keep the families entertained, the families of these SS officers, and in particular his wife. And so there are old photographs of these families wandering through the zoo, and it's literally right next to the prisoners' camp. You can see the barbed wire just a few meters away, but I think maybe at the time there was a bit more tree growth, but yeah, there was a bear pit, there were monkeys. It's very shocking sometimes how much daily life carried on right next to the brutal things that were happening in some of these concentration, or in all of these concentration camps.
There's a movie, the Zookeeper's Wife. Is that part of that, do you think, that whole thing?
You know, I haven't seen it, but I have been meaning to because I was curious. I don't think that that's the same. As far as I know, it's not the same zoo.
Okay.
No, it was in, I think that's set in like Poland or one of those countries, and it was an actual, you know, a zoo that existed, and then when the Nazis came in, they sort of took it over, and the zookeeper and his wife were helping. They were helping refugees and helping them get out. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't remember exactly how, but it had something to do with being able, you know, getting food for the animals and so forth, that they could hide people in the grain sacks or something like that. I mean, you know, you talk about, you know, what humans are capable of, both, but it's both, you know, these books, and this is another reason I think why this era is so, why we're so drawn to stories about it. It's not just the horrible things that humans are capable of, but the good things too, the self-sacrifice, the and even the people. I mean, the Dutch Wife really shows that even the people who are sort of participating in the horror aren't all bad, and maybe think they've been told, they've been had it beaten into them sometimes that what they're doing is for the greater good. And it's such a paradox that we have to deal with, this idea of nationalism often leads to horrible things, but people think they're doing it for good reasons. Is that?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I think for me, that was really central to what I was trying to accomplish with the novel. I really wanted to show the way everyday people's lives were completely taken off course with the outbreak of the war, the rise of Nazi ideology in Germany. And so on the one hand, I have Marijke, who's just a regular Dutch citizen who becomes involved in the resistance. And on the other hand, then I have Karl, who is upper middle class German citizen, starts out with not very many political aspirations or anything, but he's swept up in this idea of nationalism and this idea that Nazism represents a high culture, a return to high culture, and the preservation of Western ideals. And I really wanted to try to get into his head and see what, you know, for me, I think I have a good sense of what people in North America, what Western Europeans were thinking during the war, how they were feeling, what they were telling themselves about Nazi ideology. But what about someone who was right in the midst of it, who was seeing it from a very nationalistic point of view?
So tell us a little bit about why, you know, you talked about Argentina and so forth, but there was some family history that inspired you to write this as well.
Yeah, so it's quite loose connections, but for me, I've always had a very strong interest in World War II history. My grandmother, she was also born in 1935, and she grew up in the Netherlands, and she was still quite young when the war ended, but that final year, 1944 to 1945, is known in the Netherlands as the hunger winter, and it was really when people were down to the last scraps of food they could find. She was pretty much living off turnips and tulip bulbs, and her brother actually died during the war at age 20, because at this time, the Nazis were calling up all able-bodied Dutch men to go do forced labor in Germany, because they were quite struggling in the war at this time to keep up with all the demands of wartime production. And he wanted to stay and be there and support his family, and ended up going into hiding and got diphtheria while he was in hiding, and there was nothing they could do because they knew if they called a doctor, then they would expose the fact that he was in hiding. So for me, that kind of just little things like that, and I have on my non-Dutch side, my father's side, relatives who were in the fighting, a great uncle who was in the Royal Air Force and died in combat. And so for me, I was just really curious by how people's lives could be completely uprooted by the war and by politics that weren't even their own country's politics, and what kind of decisions they would make to get themselves through it.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Ellen Keith, author of The Dutch Wife. Ellen, would you like to read a little bit from the novel?
Yes, I would be happy to.
Great.
So I will read you a section from just the first chapter of the novel, and just as a little bit of background, it is right after Marijke and her husband have been captured, and they've just been separated and sent to these separate concentration camps in Germany. And Marijke is at Ravensbrück, which is a women's camp, but she's been there several weeks already. My chance came on a cool morning near the end of June. At 4 o'clock, the reveille sirens woke us. An SS officer with a clipboard walked down the rows with a female guard. With a cleft chin and sagging neck, he appeared even older than my father, the type of man I'd expect to see bundled up by the fireplace in a cafe back in Amsterdam, smoking a pipe and complaining about the persistent rain. Whenever this officer passed a woman with light hair and fair skin, he stopped to look her up and down. Some he pulled aside. When he got to me, he asked where I was from. And when I told him, he reached out to cut my breast. Good shape, he remarked. He noticed my number on his clipboard and ordered me to join the others. Attractive girls, all of them. Despite their pale, bruised skin, they looked younger and healthier than the rest of the inmates. We huddled together but broke into rows of five as the officer approached. I pinched my cheeks to draw out some color into them. How many times had I seen it before? Women pulled out of the line, never to return. He surveyed us with a wry smile. Consider yourselves lucky. I'm going to offer you a rare opportunity, a chance to serve the Führer, to help promote the efficiency and operations of camps across the Third Reich. Strip, he ordered. At that, I unbuttoned my shift. Goose pimples flared across my chest as it fell at my feet. Some women tried to cover themselves, but I knew well enough to keep my hands at my sides. The officer circled us, removing a shadow of a girl with a spine that stuck out like a string of beads, and two women with misshapen breasts. He ordered them back to the work commandos before returning to position in front of us. I want 16 volunteers to service the prisoners at our new bordellos. We need some ripe, willing young women. It took me a moment to understand what he meant. My skin started to prickle, bringing flashes of an Amsterdam alley, low necklines and tawdry earrings, drunken soldiers stumbling out of doorways, smears of cherry lipstick on their chins. Through the Führer's generosity, you'll receive fresh food and a quarter of your earnings, and you'll be released from the camp after 6 months of service. He grinned, letting that remark dangle. I touched my hand to my side, yearning for the reassuring weight of my wedding band, which the Nazis had confiscated upon my arrival. A pain hit my stomach, as if someone had reached in and pressed down on my gut. 6 months. Could it be? The girls around me shifted their weight. Perhaps their own stomachs were growling, their minds clouding with visions of hot dinners, of comfortable trains with dining cars headed away from Germany. Who is willing to service the Reich? He asked. At first, nobody moved. Eyes remained cast to the ground. The only sounds were the distant steps of marching prisoners. Think about it, he said. quarters with proper beds and hot running water. A crow cawed, drawing my gaze upward. The bird sailed high above the compound, a dark speck against the dark sky. It swept past us, beyond the electrified confines of the camp, and disappeared. A girl stepped forward. A green delinquent triangle marked the uniform at her feet. Her hair was the color of butter, and she wore a certain confidence, like she'd spent years weaving her way up through the German underworld. I wondered what had brought her here, if she'd been accused of theft or maybe assault. The officer nodded and turned to us. One by one, girls hesitantly offered themselves. Some looked as young as 20, others 26 or 27. Only two had brown hair. The rest were textbook Aryans. The officer rapped a pen against his clipboard in impatience. If no one else volunteers, I'll select someone. Hunger scraped at my insides. I pictured a plate of fresh fruit and even a slice of meat. Imagine being granted my freedom. But I considered that the officer might be lying. He watched us without any emotion. Yet if he'd wanted to, he could have driven into camp and carted us all away without a word of explanation. 2 days earlier, on the way to the factory, I'd passed a group of women digging ditches, the roughest work of all. One stood knee-deep in water and mud, wincing as she heaved the shovel over her shoulder. She'd rolled up her sleeve to reveal a fierce rash, a clear sign of typhus. In a few days, she would be dead, her body fed to the greedy fryers at the crematorium. A heated room, a hot shower, away from the scourge of life in Berman, a chance to maybe feel human again. Where are you sending them, sir? The woman beside me shook as if she couldn't believe she dared speak up. Without a glance in her direction, he swatted away the question. To my men's camp, Buchenwald. That name, one that had taken seed in the transit camps at Cook as I spotted Teo's back retreating into the cattle car. A rumor passed on in whispers as we wives and mothers, sisters and daughters, watched through our tears, watched our very purpose for living disappear down the rails. A name I'd also heard at Ravensbrück, but one that had never seemed like anything more than a word, a spot in my mind where I'd tucked him for safekeeping. But it was a real place, a camp with fences and a crematorium and a brothel. The officer cleared his throat. Well? I knelt down to pick up my uniform, making sure to glance up and look that dirty moth straight in the eye. I felt the solid ground against my palm, dirt beneath my fingernails. Then I stood and took a step forward.
And that was Ellen Keith reading from The Dutch Wife. Did you go to Buchenwald to research?
Yes, for me that was really important. I wanted to make sure that I could have some sense of place and atmosphere if I was going to be writing about this camp, especially given the gravity of what happened to people there. So I made a couple of trips to the camp and also to Ravensbrück, where this particular scene is set. And it was a very emotional experience. The first trip I made was when I was still very much in the middle of writing the first draft, and that was more for kind of gathering information and trying to orientate myself a bit. And then the next trip was right after I had just handed in the finished manuscript to my editor. And being there that second time, I had really felt like the characters had come to life for me. So I almost had trouble separating in my head the idea that these were not real people, and that the places that I was standing when I was standing in front of the remains of the brothel and the infirmary barracks, that this was just where the characters from my imagination had stood and not the real versions of themselves.
Wow. Did you have the opportunity to talk to any survivors from those camps?
No, unfortunately not. I don't think there are many survivors still alive. I did speak to a survivor from the camp, from Buchenwald, yes. But not from the brothel specifically, I think that's what you're asking.
Yeah.
So yeah, the first time I went there happened to be on the anniversary of the liberation of the camp. So there was a big ceremony and a number of survivors of the camp were in attendance. And one in particular was a Canadian prisoner of war who had been in the Air Force, and a number of these, there was a group of Royal Air Force pilots, crew, who were taken as prisoners of war and sent to Buchenwald. It was a sort of this one-time thing that was rather unusual for prisoners of war to be sent to a full concentration camp. So I had a very moving chat with this man.
You know, I just read somewhere that most of the high school students in the United States know nothing about Auschwitz or any of that.
Really?
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. I mean, of all things that, you know, we have to teach is about some of the things of the past that, because they say, if you don't, you know, if we don't know our past, we're doomed to repeat it. And, of course, sometimes we do it anyway. We repeat it anyway, but at least we could, you know. Yeah.
Well, yeah, exactly.
The Jews were scapegoats for Germany's unhappiness, correct?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, for me, again, that goes back to why I wanted to explore a little bit of what happened in Argentina in this novel as well, because of the idea of history repeating itself and the fact that we would allow things of this scale, this type of brutality to happen again. And there's still conflicts going on today where, you know, cases of genocide. And I do wonder what it takes for us to actually overcome this and fully learn from our mistakes and prevent these things from happening in the future.
Indeed.
So, Ellen, how long did you work on this novel?
Well, from the time that I first came up with initial idea to the time that it appeared in book form was just over 3 years. I spent a year writing the first draft, and then everything after that was in revisions and then eventually working with an editor.
That's pretty fast, actually, I would say. Now, I know this is your first published novel. Is it the first novel that you wrote?
It's the first one I wrote more than 30 pages of. It's the fourth novel that I started, and the other ones were throughout, elementary school and in high school. And this novel, actually, the reason I wrote it so quickly was because it was my master's thesis. As mentioned when you're introducing me, that I did a Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing, and so this novel in manuscript form was my thesis for that program, and that forced me to really focus on it and work on it in a much more dedicated way than I think I would have if I hadn't been doing that program.
What was the inspiration for you to do the master's in creative writing?
Well, I think, again, it comes down to that question of work ethic, and I know that I'm quite a procrastinator, and I really wanted to make sure that, you know, if I say I want to write a historical fiction novel, that I actually would follow it through. And I think for me, one of the most difficult parts of writing a novel is just having the stamina to see it through from start to finish, and the sheer amount of time it takes to come up with a whole draft. And I knew that I work really well with deadlines, and I wanted to have some sort of structure imposed. But I think beyond that, I really saw the value in learning more about writing as a craft and trying to treat it like a profession, even when that was far from reality at the time. And I wanted to, the more serious I took it and the more I looked at it as something that I could learn and improve on and really focus on building skills, then I thought the better chance I had of actually publishing a book one day.
I was going to say, most people who come out of a master's in fine art program don't come out with a book a publishable novel immediately. I mean, a few do, but a lot of people don't. Was there, you know, were you just lucky, or was there something that you did that increased your chances?
Well, I was very fortunate in that the manuscript won a competition that was put on by HarperCollins Canada and my university in collaboration also with a literary agency. So my manuscript won this competition, and then as a result, I was awarded agent representation and a publishing deal in one. So I skipped a huge amount of the normal journey that you go through when trying to find a publisher. But on top of that, I think I was very focused while writing, and I really was open to making major changes between the first draft that my thesis supervisor saw and in the second draft. I kept 40% of the plot of the novel, and which equated to 150 pages and 6 months of work. So I think if I hadn't been open to that kind of criticism and willing to make those kind of changes, which I don't know that I would have done very easily if it wasn't in the context of a master's program, I think I would have been stuck for a long time, and it would have been hard for me to move forward into a more polished draft.
Wow. That must have been really hard, though, to cut all of that out. And was it a plot that point that was sort of, or a plot thread that was interspersed throughout everything else?
Yes, actually. So you had asked, the question earlier had come up about the connection and how it's revealed, the connection between the Argentina section and the World War II section, and that was actually where the cutting took place. There was a lot more in Argentina, a lot more of what happens to Carl and Marijke after the war in the 1970s. So you saw two full storylines from their perspectives in the 1970s, and those were the two storylines that I cut.
Well, you could write another novel about that.
I do still have all the material, yeah.
And I think that would be interesting. I'd like to read that.
Now, yeah, it was.
Go ahead.
Oh, it was a big shift. I was initially really focusing on kind of what happens after the war, and whether you're a perpetrator or a victim, what kind of trauma are you trying to process, and how does that affect you later in your life, and that was really interesting to me, but the novel had just grown and it couldn't hold all of the story that I wanted to fill it with.
I can understand that. Yeah.
Now, Ellen, on your website, you talk about that you traveled around the world for about 10 months, and that's when you went to Argentina, and then you ended up in Europe and moved to Holland. Was that all after you wrote the book?
A bit of both. Well, actually, no, I think that was all before I started the book.
Okay.
But then while I was writing the book, I was also traveling a lot. I mentioned that I went to these concentration camps, but I also made another trip back to Argentina and spent about a month there trying to do research and do some writing. And the master's program that I was doing was entirely online. So
wow.
That gave me a lot of flexibility, and I was traveling almost nonstop in the couple of years that I was working on this.
Wow.
Do you think I'm kind of like, traveling like that can be very stressful. You have to adapt to each new place, but it also keeps you very open. I'm just curious about how, you know, writing a novel and doing a whole master's program while you're traveling and living in a new place to begin with. It just seems like a lot.
It was a very volatile time in my life. I was actually, the reason I was doing so much traveling is I was very set on living in Amsterdam, but I was having trouble maintaining a residence permit there because I was studying through a Canadian university and wasn't recognized as a Dutch student. So I was kind of bouncing back and forth between Europe and other places as long as I was allowed to be in Europe, and that was, I felt very displaced for a while, and I think in some ways that does come through in the story. I see certain scenes that I wrote that, and I remember where I wrote them, and sometimes I think that feeling of being displaced on a very, very, very small scale, I could relate to some of those feelings.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. So now you're settled in Amsterdam. Do you find it harder or easier to write?
I do find it hard. I think, and a lot of that is just the social side that comes with being more settled and having, I have a day job. I work for a nonprofit organization in Amsterdam. So that takes up most of my work week, and then I'm trying to squeeze in writing on the evenings and weekends. So that, of course, changes things a lot. And then also just when you're a bit more settled, you have a much different social life than if you're on the go traveling on your own.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's like almost 5 p.m. Central Time here, so it must be quite late at night there for you.
It is 5 to midnight.
Oh. Well, I hope we're not keeping you up later than normal.
Oh no, not at all.
Okay.
I'm a night owl. I do most of my writing around this time. So.
Okay. So can you tell
me this.
Oh, go ahead, Mom.
I was going to ask her if she associated with other writers. I mean, are your friends writers too, or?
Yeah, I think that if I could say the biggest benefit that came out of doing a master's program in creative writing would be the friendships that came out of it. More than, I mean, I learned a lot about writing as a craft, but for me, it was so valuable to meet other writers who shared my frustrations, my aspirations, and who I can talk to about writing. And they were very important in the creation of this novel, and were always there to offer encouragement and support and read chapters and give me feedback. And I think it's very different getting feedback from another writer than, say, from, you know, a romantic partner or your sister. You get a very different type of feedback. And I very much appreciated what that's added to my writing experience.
Well, you get another type of feedback, and also it may be easier to take criticism because it's not as personal.
Yeah, I think so. You know, I'm not a person with very thick skin, so the idea of putting yourself out there and your work out there has been a bit of a challenge for me, but I think it really helped also doing this master's program and learning how to critique other people's work, what type of feedback is valuable, and more importantly, how to take it yourself, and so that when you do have really big decisions to make, like, do I cut 150 pages of this plot, you are able to look at your own work a little more objectively, and I think that's very important.
Now, when I Googled you and the book, I noticed that it has gotten a lot of attention. And I understand it was a bestseller in Canada this past summer. But so it's been reviewed quite a bit. That's good and maybe not so good sometimes. How have you handled the reviews?
Yeah, I think that is, like I said, a big challenge. It's been very exciting to see reviews. There's been some very really positive reviews, some not so positive reviews, but I think for me, one thing that I've tried to keep in mind and something that I'm starting to understand more and more as I have readers reach out to me and give me their thoughts on the book is just how much everyone brings their own perspective and their own experiences and background to the table when they're reading a book, regardless of what the subject matter is. We all interpret things in completely different ways. You know, people catch on to the connection between the characters in my novel at completely different stages, and that shapes their understanding of the book. And so I think for me, it's been actually really wonderful to see how many different interpretations there are out there of this story that I've worked on, and I really like seeing it. Even when some of the feedback is a little more critical, I think it's a really good learning experience for me ultimately.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Ellen Keith, author of The Dutch Wife. Ellen, can you share with us what you're writing next?
Well, I'm very much in the early stages. I'm in trying to outline a novel right now, another historical fiction novel, but I think it will be set in, hopefully, in New York City in the 1950s. I'm still trying to work out the details, so I can't say too much yet at this stage, but I'm trying to get a big shift. I still love historical fiction. I love kind of that era, but I do want to write something a little lighter for this next novel.
Now, with The Dutch Wife, did you start with the kind of the themes and the locations and then build the characters around that, or did you start with character?
A bit of both. Actually, I found a notebook recently that had the line that sparked the idea for the novel, and the line was initially for a short story, and it was an SS officer escapes to Argentina and becomes a big tango star later in his life, which is not how the novel plays out with it. But I did really love the idea of tying World War II and tango and Argentina into the story initially. So that was where it started, was really with the character of an SS officer. And I thought, I know I'd like to do something with Argentina. Where do I go from here?
Wow. It was really interesting the way you were able to do that, to seeing the whole thing interwoven together, because, you know, it was such a, how many years in time? 20 years? And, so that was great. It really was. More longer than that.
Yeah.
Do you know how the story was going to play out when you started writing?
Yeah. Well, I am one of those people that I said before, I liked the structure that having these deadlines for my master's imposed on me. So I kind of approached writing it in the same way, in that I wrote a very detailed outline before I started. Of course, things changed. That outline included those two plot lines that are no longer in the novel. So I knew where I was headed, but I tried to go in that direction with a very flexible, open mind.
What was one of the biggest surprises that showed up for you while writing?
I think really it was the whole idea of these prisoner brothels. For me, that was never meant to be central to the novel. I really initially was planning to focus more on the life of Karl Müller, the SS officer. But once I learned more about these prisoners' brothels, that aspect of the novel kind of came into its own and took center stage. I think Marijke's voice really spoke to me and began to outshine the others in a way. So that's how it became The Dutch Wife. It was being the central focus, and that was something I wouldn't have expected at all going into it.
Was it hard to decide on a title, even though the focus became more about her? Was the title obvious to you, or did that take some thought?
Actually, the title was something that my publisher suggested. I initially had a title that was very symbolic, but very dark, in a more of a Stephen King kind of way. I initially sent in the manuscript titled Blood Road, which is the name of the road that leads into Buchenwald, the camp. And it's called that because a lot of prisoners died while building it. And for me, it was kind of symbolic of the whole story, but also the generational ties and the idea of how you continue to live with trauma of the war long after the war.
Wow.
But yeah, that was not quite the title for this one. I think it screamed horror novel or thriller in a much more of a way than the novel actually is.
Well, that's a good point. That's a good point. So you talked about how winning the contest through the university, through the master's program, got you the agent and the publishing contract. How was, you know, you had done a lot of work, obviously, editing with your, in the program, in the MFA program. But did the editor for HarperCollins then do, was there even another editing process that you went through with them?
Yeah, so there was. We didn't do a lot of big changes after the manuscript won the competition and I started working with an editor at HarperCollins. But it was more trying to enhance some of the character development and try to look a little more carefully at the connection between the Argentina storyline and the World War II storyline and look at what kind of clues I needed to drop in along the way. And so that was a really interesting process. I think I'm... I studied history during my undergraduate degree, so I was ready to keep going on for 2 years getting immersed in the historical research and adding detail after detail. It was good for me to have someone there who really had kind of the oversight and could make the judgment call of when it was ready.
That is a hard thing to decide. When is it good enough?
And I think from what I know from the other writers and other types of artists that I've spoken to, I think it's, you never feel that your own work is completely ready, but there comes a point where you're just, you know, sitting there changing one word on a page here, there, back and forth, tiny, insignificant word choices, and then that's when you're realizing, okay, what am I really contributing, enhancing the story anymore?
Yeah, and if you show it to someone new, they're always going to have, like, suggestions that maybe were things that you changed already to, you know, because someone else had suggested something else, and you can get caught up with taking, like, having too many cooks in the making the soup too. So it sounds like you were able to avoid that.
Oh yeah, but that's true, and it goes back to the idea of everyone bringing their own experiences to the table
exactly.
When they read a book. So one person will have a completely different opinion on where the story should go from someone else.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, this has been really enjoyable, and I found The Dutch Wife to be a very intriguing book, very good story. I wanted to know how it was going to end. And and we're about out of time.
My outtake is kind of long today, but it's very important, I think, that we hear it.
So Mom always gives us some final words at the end.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
This was a piece of paper found on the body of a dead child at the Ravensbrück concentration camp. O Lord, remember not only the men and women of goodwill, but also those of ill will. But do not remember all the suffering they have inflicted on us. Remember instead the fruits that we have brought, thanks to our suffering, our comradeship, our loyalty, our humility, our courage, our generosity, the greatness of heart which has grown out of all this. And when those who have inflicted suffering on us come to judgment, let all the fruits which we have borne be their forgiveness.
Wow, very powerful words. Thank you for sharing that.
And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.